Blog Talk Radio. Welcome, audience, to the One Cell, One Light radio show with your host, Dr. Hildegard Stanninger, commonly known as Dr. Hildy. I have a very special guest on with me today, and we're going to discuss a lot of work that she's been doing in reference to breast implants and helping individuals heal from the recovery of them rupturing and the surgical procedures to remove them. But I have had the pleasure of being on Dr. Kolb's show in the past. She has a morning radio show in the Atlanta, Georgia area on Saturdays, and I thoroughly enjoyed the times that I was a guest on her show. It was most informative. And she recently... Dr. Kolb has a new book out, and I encourage our listeners to get this book, and we have the link at the website, The Naked Truth About Breast Implants from Harm to Healing. And it's well written. It covers the areas of information that is shared with certain patients or individuals that she's evaluated, and what their situations were and how it relates into the recovery of having a ruptured breast implant or the toxic effects from an implant. Dr. Kolb, thank you for being on the show with me. I appreciate it very much.
Well, thanks, Hildy. It's been wonderful interviewing you in the past, and I wanted to tell the listening audience that we don't get much of a toxicology education in medical school. In fact, virtually none. And with your help, I was able to understand a lot of the toxic problems that really aren't even in the medical literature other than a little bit about platinum. But there's a lot more chemicals and a lot more problems that are caused by the chemicals and the silicone coming out of the implants.
Right. And you and I have shared that, being audience, that when we think of implants, and I was sharing with Dr. Kolb that I was so impressed with our writer who does our show's promotional little blurb for our radio show, because I didn't even know they were doing operations in the 1800s for implants and putting adipose in, and let alone glass and ox bone cartilage. But the thing is with implants, and we're going to discuss as we go in the show, basically the two forms that are currently available versus years ago when it was the Dow implants and in the past in the 60s. If you can imagine your couch having that foam in it, you know, in the covers of the cushion, that polyurethane, that was used even as implants, and then it would break down and cause all kinds of toxicity within the individual. So the history of silica, as from the dirt, silicon dioxide to silicon to the silicone aerated gels, to all of it, there's many different compounds involved in the manufacture, and I appreciate you sharing that with the audience, the need of knowing toxicology or networking with someone that has that skill in a practice of medicine, because, as you say, it is not in the curriculum, and it is so needed when you're trying to age your patient and getting well, but it might have another factor in it. Like you even brought out the platinum. Platinum was used in these implants to use as an antimicrobial agent, but when you're trying to evaluate do they have too much platinum exposure, like a heavy metal exposure, you can't even get the biological test sometimes for it.
Yeah, Some of the patients were extremely ill with platinum, and you may have known of P.J. Brent. You may have heard of her.
Mm-hmm.
P.J. Brent was an activist. She became sick from her ruptured implant. She had two children before they ruptured and two children after, and she breastfed. And the two children after had a great deal of neurological problems. In fact, one of them was my patient because PJ lived in Atlanta.
Uh-huh.
And she basically was working for the children, you know, as an advocate. And then she ended up allegedly jumping off the parking garage at Perimeter Mall, which is about a mile away from here, a week or two before her trial with Bristol-Myers Squibb, which is interesting. But anyway, she didn't leave a suicide note. And her attorney called me and said that she had massive amounts of platinum, and the two children that were sick had platinum, but the two children that didn't did not have platinum. So I'm thinking that maybe the platinum was also important in the neurological problems that we were seeing in the children. And also two other things. If you have lipomas, I think that lipomas are the body's way of blocking off platinum. People with multiple lipomas tended to have platinum, and people with new onset asthma tended to have platinum. So clinically, that's what we would look for. But we do hair analysis on people to see if they had platinum exposure, and quite a few do. The new implants, by the way, still have platinum. Mentor did a study comparing the gel. This is a gel, not saline. Its gel implant to Allergan's gel implant, and showed that its implant leaks less platinum than the Allergan implants leak.
Right, and
so it's still in there.
Right, it's still there, and it's as the antimicrobial. And the thing is, too, even though there's the other version, the saline, it's called a double lumen, and inside the center of it, it still is like a bag of the silicone versus then the saline around it, all covered with a high-density polyethylene or, you know, I'm going to call it that, like a baggie that keeps it together. And
right.
our body does not really respond very well to foreign material in the body, especially like a plastic bag, and starts building up proteins against it or allergic responses, et cetera. And I know we're going to go into that in depth, but with each one of these, one is the polyurethane ones were among the worst, okay? They were done in Switzerland and around other areas. I mean, literally just like putting your, Dr. Cope, your living room couch foam in your body.
Mm-hmm.
It was really bad. And the other thing is, that after that, I want to bring out too, and people don't realize it, that after those battles with the breast implant in the legal arena, I believe it was our Congress that passed a law that the manufacturers are not held responsible for any of the effects. But if it's done under clinical research or anything, it may be that researcher who's responsible for any of the effects.
I'll tell you exactly what that was. The Supreme Court, this was in a Medtronix case. Medtronix is a large producer of things like pacemakers and heart stuff, but, you know, things that are critical. The Supreme Court ruled that if something was FDA approved, that patients could not bring federal class action lawsuits. So that was what it was. And
that's,
so I guess you can still sue individually, but, of course, nobody can afford to do that unless they're really independently wealthy. But class action lawsuits was what it protected them against. So with FDA approval, they can't do a federal civil lawsuit.
Yeah, I wonder if that only applies to implants or anything that's FDA approved.
You know, I don't know, but it was in the implant arena. It wasn't implant company, so definitely breast implants were considered to be under that. And so unless the Supreme Court rules differently, which they could at some time, that's the what do you call it, the standard, in the legal
right.
standard.
Right. Now, in your practice of can we share if you can give some examples of what happens? We've made the term ruptured implant versus having the whole implant. Can you define what you would call a ruptured implant for the audience?
Well, a ruptured implant is one where the silicone shell, which is actually called a sialastic shell, it's solid silicone, breaks. So it's either a valve defect, the valve doesn't work properly and things leak out, or in the case of saline, if saline is inside. But with silicone, some part of the implant leaks and you get silicone outside the capsule. But you can get leakage of silicone through an intact but leaky capsule, not capsule, but shell, and that would still make the patient just as ill. In other words, the silicone mm-hmm. gel kind of oozes out diffusely, not where you can really see the gel, but it oozes out microscopically.
Correct.
And you get it in the lymph nodes, so it you see it in the lymph nodes. And then I had one patient who was deathly ill. She had the entire contents of her gel leak out, but her shells were intact. There was no hole in them.
So it leaked. It leached
completely
through the shell. Yeah.
Completely out, right.
Yeah.
Now, and I wanted to go back to something you said earlier, Hildy. These are completely different companies with different kinds of silicone and different ingredients. There were some silicones that were very runny. There were some silicones that are very solid.
Hello?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. I'm getting a beeping sound. Okay.
Yeah, me too. I don't know what that is.
I'm not sure. Anyway, I'm glad you're still there. But in any case, we're not dealing with one thing. And then the polyurethane breaks down into something that is carcinogenic. So, and that's totally different. So you can't really say it's one thing. You've got to look at chemical toxicity, silicone toxicity, and biotoxicity. The biotoxicity are actually from the mold and yeast. They produce biotoxins that can make people very ill. That's what is known as sick building syndrome. But the silicone toxicity I like to term as people who they can get a little bit of silicone in their body or a lot of silicone in their body, but they develop a fairly significant autoimmune disease right away. And that's genetically determined, HLA-B27, HLA-DR53.
Yes,
so in the
early studies, they used the HLA-A01 with the 102, which basically they found that the more that you were Euro-Asian or Chinese, you had more susceptibility to the purple rash that occurred with some individuals. Like they had a purple rash on their forehead or on their arms or anything. But that is so true that no matter what the implant is, audience, you need to look at what its chemical composition, evaluate its effect upon your body if you so choose to have implants. But basically, I know I work with them rupturing or aiding the physician in getting the information that way. I don't know if your practice is also reconstructive where they may choose to have that augmentation after maybe a breast removal or that from cancer.
Yeah, right now until stem cell fat transfer is FDA approved, and even after it's FDA approved in some people because you can only take so much fat, especially if they're not real fat, we still need to have some dependence on implants. I hear about problems all over the world, so that includes the PIPs and the other brands that aren't used in the U.S. I can tell you that, in my opinion, if somebody is going to have implants, the safest implant, in my opinion, is the Allergan Smooth Saline. Texturing especially with Allergan, but also with the other brands. There's going to be a paper published shortly on this with 109 new cases, is associated with a rare lymphoma. And that is probably not worth the risk, especially with the lost salt technique of texturing that Allergan uses. I would not recommend that, although other textured implants have been associated with that lymphoma as well. I believe that's a chemical cause of that, although the researchers believe it's a physical cause. It may be both. I don't know.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't do texturing in anything. And then gel, some reconstruction patients do need to have gel implants. You know, some of these implants are 800cc implants, and the thin, thin walls that can exist. In other words, when you take the breast off, especially if the woman is very thin, you don't have much tissue there. And if you put a saline implant in, it can really not do well because of the rippling and everything. So sometimes a silicone implant is needed for reconstruction. But if somebody wants to get it for cosmetic reasons, I would recommend smooth saline, Allergan, and change them out every 10 years. And this is the most important thing, avoid mold. Don't sleep in moldy houses or, you know, condos. You know, avoid scuba diving equipment that has mold in it. Avoid, you know, mattresses that have gotten wet and have mold in them. When you breathe in mold and you have a foreign material in your body, it's probably not just breast implants, it's probably any foreign material, you can get a biofilm around that implant that has mold in it. And then eventually you'll get bacteria.
Right, because it migrates. The any of these microorganisms, the mold, the bacteria, or anything, will migrate to an implant or that foreign body, because majority of these implants, they have either a carbon base with it, so that it acts like food for them, and it just
right.
grows in there and makes that biofilm, which is basically, audience, a protective membrane around the organism and your body, your tissue, and it's like got little straws, which they call microtubules, and stick it into your tissue and take your amino acids out, so
mm-hmm.
the bacteria or the mold can live. Yeah, that's called
yeah.
a symbiotic relationship that way. And also, majority, too, when they do rupture, and they can rupture not only from, I'm going to say, manufacturer defect or something along that line, mm-hmm. but as you brought out, Dr. Kolb, the leaching effect as osmosis as it goes through the membrane. A prime example, we all had this when we were in school, you take a Ziploc bag, plastic, and you put some colored water, blue, in it, and then you put it within a beaker of regular water, you know, no color in it, and the colored water leaches through the plastic bag. So
silicone is hydrophobic, so it goes through plastic even better than water does.
Well,
chemically,
it just concentrates those little molecules to go through those little tiny microscopic
That's
holes
right.
that way. It's amazing.
And the other thing I want to mention is that another problem can occur, especially in a saline implant that has a particular valve on it that is less sturdy. What happens is that valve gets a microscopic crack in it, and then the mold can go into the implant and actually live in the saline. They proved that mold and bacteria can grow in the saline in the laboratory. And then if your audience wants to go look at Animal Planet, Monsters Inside Me, or even Discovery UK had Monsters Inside Me, I'm on an episode showing a black implant with aspergillus in it that came out of a woman who got a mastitis after breastfeeding. She had a glandular implant. In other words, it wasn't under the muscle. Had it been under the muscle, it might have been protected. And it got mold in it because she was on long-term antibiotics without antifungals. So if you have a breast implant and somebody wants to put you on long-term antibiotics for, you know, an infection, that's okay, but you must go on antifungals. And if you develop pain or a neurological condition or an autoimmune condition, you must consider that you might have mold in or around your breast implant.
Mm-hmm. Now, with implants, can you nurse? I always thought you couldn't if you had a child and you wanted to nurse the child.
Well, it would be safer to nurse if you did not have texturing, if you did not have silicone gel, and if you had it under the muscle. Theoretically, under the muscle, it's not going to get in the breast implants. And I always do total muscular coverage when I put implants in, or try to anyway, for that reason. Now, there may be chemicals that get out into the bloodstream eventually, and that might have small effects more on the placenta, I would think, through the placenta to the baby in the womb.
Mm-hmm.
Breast milk may not be a factor unless it is concentrated in the breast milk. And you probably know better than I what kind of chemicals
right.
get concentrated in breast milk. But, you know, in general, children tend to be healthy if they breastfeed, unless the woman has a silicone rupture, a really bad leakage, or high levels of platinum. I would say platinum would be a contraindication to breastfeeding.
Right. And also, because I was thinking just of the pressure as the child got older in nursing or anything, it may cause trauma to the breast area where the implant was. Just as I've had even individuals that had an implant and they were a professional nurse and of a psychiatric ward, and the patient got rowdy with them and punched them in the breast and it ruptured. So sometimes you have physical injury that causes a rupture,
right.
and it's very good to always have the evaluation. I do not know if with the newer implants, with the breast implants, if they're putting any kind of, I'm going to call it a biosensor in it or anything to see or measure if there's any leakage. Have you heard
anything?
I haven't heard anything like that. So
no, and I don't think, in my experience, the leakage from the newer implants is no different than the older implants that were made after 85. Now, there was implants that were made in the 70s that had the very high bleed silicone coming through the wall. You might remember in 85,
yeah.
Dow Corning came out with a low bleed implant that did protect somewhat until about 8 to 15 years. My implant, my left implant, I had Dow Corning silicone gel under the muscle. My left implant leaked. My right didn't leak. So all the symptoms were on one side. So it was easy for me to say what symptoms were from my leaking implant.
Right. And you personally experienced this, and that's how you were so able from that experience help your patients that way too, I know.
Right. I'm sort of a medical intuitive, kind of similar to yourself. So when it happens in us, we tend to get ideas and that we can test them ourselves, and if they work, we can use them on the patients.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And they usually work very well. They usually work very
mm-hmm.
well. The other thing is, too, on the website, as we go into this, there was a beautiful article that your staff sent us in reference to the study of what they are doing in reference to comparative study of the Style 410 highly corrosive silicon breast implant core study that was done in 2007. It was a clinical study group, but what I liked about this study is it also brought out in reference to certain areas where not only were the pains, scarring, delayed wound healing, because many times individuals, they may have an implant or that, but or even have them removed, and then they have delayed wound healing from the incision, which I feel is reaction to if the implant was ruptured, the silicone and its amount of the loss of the glutathione or any of these other protective mechanisms in the body to help in healing and re-knitting the skin back together that may be impaired
yep.
because of that.
Well, when we do the explant, we do see delayed wound healing, especially on the side that has the infection. You know, we do a culture for bacteria, but we also know that there's fungus in there because we determine that on the eye test. And when we send it into Micometrics, of course, there's been fungus. But, you know, we have a whole bunch of different bacteria and fungi in organisms in the biofilm. And, of course, some of that gets out on into the wound. It just has to, even though we irrigate with antibacterial things. But those sides do not heal as well. And, in general, the other wound healing is because of two things, I think. One is malabsorption. A lot of these women have chronic dysbiosis of the gut, and they don't absorb proteins well, so they have a chronic problem with that. You helped me understand Raynaud's disease one time as an arginine deficiency brought up by methylethyl ketone, which was, of course, one of the components in the implant. But I think malabsorption can occur, and then they don't heal well. And then the last one is they have significant immune deficiencies. So, you know, if your body doesn't have a good immune system, it's not going to heal very well.
Correct, correct. And what we're saying, too, audience, is that there's multiple factors or multiple parameters that occur with either the rupture of the implant and just plain your body responding to having an implant within the body. I have a general question, Dr. Cope. When these implants are inserted into a body, are they coated with like an antibacterial agent or anything like that?
No, not that I know of. We do rinse the pocket with bacitracin or ANSEF, and we used to put ANSEF actually in the saline, and that actually does turn the implant dark eventually, or that not the saline, it turns the saline dark color eventually. So just because they remove a dark colored implant doesn't mean there's mold in it. They actually have to look and see if there's mold in it. But so essentially what we do now is rinse the pocket out with antibiotic and then but don't put antibiotic inside the saline. It goes into the implant.
Yeah, and that color change with the saline just by the exposure to the other compound, maybe its reaction with the platinum, just as, you know, silver, a piece of silver tarnishes when it's in the exposure to oxygen, you know, over time, it may be. Did in any of your studies or experience, I know many people drink soda pops, et cetera, versus the diet ones where there might be, you know, unnatural sweeteners in it, more chemically type, in particular ones of those sweetening agents that make methanol. Did you see any correlation with more toxic effects of ones that used artificial sweeteners versus non, or didn't have that opportunity?
I had an interesting patient the other day. She came in with silicone implants that were just like 4 years old, but she did have some enlarged lymph nodes on the right, which might very well be leakage of the right implant. But her, it just didn't, what she was having did not sound like other neurological problems I've seen with patients. So I asked her, I said, it's something you're doing every day. I said, have you been exposed to anything with aspartame in it? And she denied it, you know, nothing with aspartame. But it turned out that wasn't quite true. She'd had her tonsils out, and the ENT doctor asked her to chew gum for some medical reason. And I said, well, I bet the gum has aspartame in it. And she went out to the car and got it, and sure enough, it did. Mm. So I believe that she was having a fair reaction to the aspartame that was causing the bizarre neurological symptoms. And then she also had things that could be silicone toxicity. So she might have had both things, but, you know, just some of the things didn't sound right. That, you know, we didn't see them in silicone patients. So, but aspartame's very, in some people, aspartame doesn't sit well with them at all.
Right. That's very true. It doesn't sit well with them at all. Now, with when someone has the implant put in, whether it's for cosmetic versus if it's for reconstruction after breast removal, how long is the average length of healing occur with them?
For putting it in?
Regular just doing it for aesthetics, beauty, I'm going to call it that, or enhancement of the body, versus someone that has gone through a major disease like cancer, may have had, chemotherapy, radiation, and then the breast augmentation process.
Well, certainly, people who've had radiation and chemotherapy, radiation can make it very difficult to put the implant in. But say they just have chemo, their immune system's going to be down. So if you don't treat the immune system and get it back going in the right direction, they will possibly have delayed healing and or complications. The regular young healthy patient, generally will have some soreness, probably for about 4 to 6 weeks. Can't really go back to, major Nautilus-type training of the pec for about 6 weeks. But most vigorous activity can be resumed at 3 to 4 weeks.
Okay. So about a month, month and a half, they recuperate from it. Because I know any type of surgery on the front chest, especially for a female, they have a lot of problems with the lymph nodes under the arms or just the muscles as a whole. And I learned something yesterday. I had a previous guest on our show, Dwayne Jones of the Little Big Gym here in Los Angeles, and he gets clients that come in for physical exercise, doing workouts, etc. But here in Los Angeles, there's many opportunities where individuals, male and female, but in particular female, want like what they call a tummy tuck and remove some fat on the lower extremities, etc. And he was sharing with me that sometimes the surgeons, they cut through the abdominal vein, and in that process, that particular group of feeding to the upper breast area to get cells and stuff like that, if that's cut, if you ever had to have breast augmentation surgery, you may not respond to it as well as what if you didn't have that vein cut. Do you have any opinion on that or any knowledge of that?
If you've had a tummy tuck, they have to be very careful when they go to do a tram flap, and move tissue back up. There are delay procedures, though. They can go in and cut vessels to increase the flap survival, and they can also study with angiograms study the vessels to see if they're intact or not. But it is true that in a tummy tuck, you could damage some vessels that might make the tissue transfer impossible, so they have to do more studies when that has happened. Mm-hmm. But tram flaps are not as utilized now as they were back in the 80s and 90s, probably because reimbursement's gone down. So I think the future of breast reconstruction is actually stem cell fat transfer. Mm-hmm. And maybe back to latissimus dorsi flaps. That's where you take the latissimus dorsi muscle from the back and swing it around to the front, and then you can inject fat, under it or above it, and even put a small implant in if you needed to. So tram flaps do have the potential problem of disrupting abdominal wall function. Most of the patients can't do strenuous things like water ski. Some can't even do sit-ups. So, for a lot of women, that's not a good trade-off.
Right, because you might, it's just limiting your options if you need those options in the future. The other thing is that with, just as you described taking the muscle from the back area, just with you describing it, it felt painful to me. Do they, if you had an implant with that type of muscle surgery, you know, meaning bringing it to the front and flapping it, they would still have to have that implant removed in 10 years too, wouldn't you think?
Right.
Or
yeah.
Do they?
Yeah, but because you have that coverage, you have the tissue from the back along with the muscle, you could probably use a saline implant, which I described earlier as being safer, rather than if you didn't have that muscle coverage. The thin muscle coverage of the chest wall might not work with a saline implant for thin-walled people. So, you know, it just depends on how much tissue you're trying to bring forward. You know, it's much easier to reconstruct a small B cup than it is a double D. You know,
right.
If you're trying to match the other side. Implants are probably here to stay. I think that they're going to be doing some things that make them safer. There's a implant under development that has different, it kind of looks like a Smurf ball or something with different categories, chambers in it, you know, different chambers, saline in each chamber so that if one chamber fails, it doesn't completely deflate. And that's an interesting idea. I think they need to keep texturing off of it. I think it's pretty well, at least in my practice, I pretty well know that texturing can flake off and get in the patient's system and interact with the immune system and give them autoimmune disease and other problems, certainly get in their lymph nodes. So texturing's a problem that would make shaped implants a problem, because all shaped implants, which are used a lot in reconstruction because you're trying to get a certain shape out of it, have to be textured, because if they're smooth, they flip over too easy. You know, you've got to get that tissue ingrowth to hold them in one place. So there's problems. You know, there's problems that need to be solved. And stem cell fat transfer will solve some of them. But for the larger reconstructions that can't do tissue transfer, implants are probably here to stay. My advice is to change them out every 10 years to avoid mold, to do some of the detox that you have on your website, I have on my website. There's silicone detox programs that for the little bit of silicone that leaks out, you can go ahead and detox that.
Right, and majority, too, of any toxicant. If you've ever had an injury to the body, say you hit your thigh a lot, you know, running into a desk or something, in those injured areas usually is where the toxin will accumulate there, because it's weaker and it's just more viable for it. So if you did have a ruptured implant or anything, if you had a history of having another type of injury, it definitely may migrate into that area as a result of that previous injury.
Yeah, and do you know that metastatic disease also goes into injured areas? Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Years ago, there was a, it was called FDA's talk paper, and they had a discussion on implants, and what they were talking about in the paper was silicone-associated, as you said, autoimmunity and connective tissue disease, which they found in this, that if the person had the breast implants and they ruptured, the silicone would react with the antibodies. But if there was like antibodies of like a cow's blood, where many of these, like if you had a vaccine or anything was made, the cow's blood protein didn't react, but as soon as silicone was with it, it reacted more aggressively as an antibody, a stronger antibody reaction. In that, I'm thinking that maybe you have this in your experience of anyone that possibly had an implant or a ruptured implant, and then they got, say, a flu vaccine or anything along that line, especially older individuals or younger individuals.
Bad idea.
Yeah, bad idea. I was thinking, would this interact with this?
Yeah, that's very true. The silicone is definitely an adjuvant, and it's an adjuvant that can cause the body to react to things. That's why there is an increased risk of autoimmune disease with a lot of silicone toxicity in the body. And there's no question that people react more severely to vaccines after if they've got silicone throughout their body. I see it all the time. I had a patient the other day wander into her pharmacy, and her pharmacist talked her into getting the flu shot. And she was deathly ill. She said she thought she was going to die. She ended up in the ER. She ended up in the hospital for 4 days. And, of course, nobody admitted that the flu shot had anything to do about it. But here is a pharmacist almost killing a patient.
Right, who's never done work with implants or surgically implemented them or removed them as you have. Yeah.
How can somebody who is not a physician write an order for a flu shot?
I don't know.
I don't either. People get, go to court in every state, probably every month, and get slapped on the hand for practicing medicine without a license.
Mm-hmm.
But all these pharmacists are allowed to give anybody that walks in their door a flu shot. And I don't have to tell you about the problems with flu shots. Without implants.
It's a chemical soup. It's what we used to call in chemical superfunds a witch's brew. It's anything new. I mean, I appreciate because, audience, Dr. Cobb mentioned some of my earlier work with Morgellons. We were comparing with silicone and implants and looking at so much other stuff. And she brought out in reference to the viral protein envelopes, which were used in coatings, with silicone and other viruses, the materials in them, the coating of them, for antimicrobial agents in luncheon meat. And now you're seeing it that was in the early 2006, 2007, and then the book came out. What I'm saying is now you go to the grocery store and you look at stuff and it's got a shine on it. It's not like real meat or it's got a coating on it.
Mm-hmm. That's high-density polyethylene around a viral phage to prevent listeria infection in lunch meat.
Right.
So when you're eating lunch meat, most brands, we think, you're eating plastic.
Right.
It's not in the casing around the lunch meat either.
Yeah, and it's not on the sausage casing like they did instead of using the intestines. It's it's come a long way, the interface of plastic into our food. And at the same time, it's like rice. They even made plastic rice, so it's artificial rice at one time. And, our body is not used to eating plastic. That's, there's no nutritional value for us.
Right, that's true.
Now, with you mentioned earlier when I'm going to say a patient comes to you, whether it's I wouldn't say a ruptured or the illness from the implant and has to have the implant removed due to hypersensitivity or any of this. You mentioned that you do hair analysis so that you can get the platinum or any of the other components. And that's good because where I was coming from earlier was blood and urine. You can't find it usually, meaning they're not available to test. It's like gold. They make gold in a lot of medications, but you can't get a gold test outside of doing the hair analysis, which
that's
is
true.
Wonderful. The thing is, with the types of tests, what additional types of tests would you recommend for someone to consider after an event like that happened, meaning a rupture or got sick from it, I would say, from just the regular implant?
Well, one rheumatologist tested 3,000 women with ruptured silicone implants and found that 3,000 had yeast. So you don't have to test for yeast. They're like AIDS patients. They have yeast. But you can test for mold with something called a visual contrast sensitivity test. It's an eye test that you look at a special diagram and tell whether the lines are going one way or the other way. Mm. And that test is very sensitive. If a patient has mold, say, in their left saline implant but not their right, only the left eye will be affected and the right eye will be normal because the neurotoxin that is the biotoxin stays on that side of the body. So I use that a lot to see about mold because we have to treat the yeast. We know that. And we also have to treat the mold. And Lamisil and Nizoral are better for treating mold. And then Diflucan and Nystatin are better for treating yeast. So, although there's some overlap in Nizoral. So we treat the mold, we treat the yeast, we treat bacteria because anytime you have pain, it is usually due to the bacteria. Burning pain sometimes is due to the mold because the mold affects the nerve. So it's more of a neurological type pain. And then, of course, we have to treat we have to do the detoxification after surgery. It's not really that valuable to detox before surgery if you've got a major leak or rupture. Things are coming out so fast, you're not going to keep up with it. So surgery is pretty important first. I've done some of the foot baths, some of the ionic foot baths before the patient's done them before and actually became more ill. So the major detoxes have to be done after surgery, in my opinion.
Right. And with many individuals after a rupture or they have chemical sensitivity to it, the plastic or anything, many of them sometimes get like asthma-like symptoms or a shortness of the breath where they're always catching their breath, trying to gasp air. And that, and when biopsies are done, they usually find a granuloma in the tissue or deposits of the actual silicone, you know, like white globs.
There's two major causes of the three major causes of the shortness of breath. The first would be platinum, because it causes a new onset adult asthma. The second would be silicone in the lungs, actually causing a restrictive lung disease. And the third is with biotoxins from mold, if their VEGF, vasoendothelial growth factor, becomes depressed, they get very short of breath. And if it gets depressed enough, they'll get a retinal detachment. So I had a wife of an ophthalmologist who had a really moldy saline implant, and she ended up, she'd had a retinal detachment. And then she came to me, and he was the one that educated me that low VEGF is associated with retinal detachment. And I already knew from Dr. Shoemaker's diagram, which you've probably seen, that low VEGF is associated with shortness of breath. So, but these people get deathly ill. I mean, they can't get out of the bed. I mean, they are really, really sick. And some of them with vast neurological problems from myelin protein antibodies or anti-myelin protein antibodies look just like they have MS. You know, they're in wheelchairs, right. They have brain lesions. If somebody isn't smart enough to do a spinal tap, which is negative for MS in these people, but positive for MS with MS, then they're going to get misdiagnosed with MS.
Right, and a lot of diagnoses are occurring with MS because it used to be that if they had 10 like lesions, marks on their brain, you know, MRI or X-ray at that a long time ago, they would be categorized or diagnosed. The physician would make that diagnosis. Now it's the interaction, and you brought out a very interesting point in reference to burning and itch, because a lot of the mycotoxins, which are the waste of the fungus that can be in the body, and going to this area where the silicone is, it generates carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, that can be burning, and also depletes the area of the niacin because the fungus needs it, and you become deficient. And I've seen a lot of people have burning hands, itchy, anus itch and feet, and as soon as they were given niacin to help with that overgrowth of the yeast, which is a fungus, and the other types of microorganisms, it aided them in getting over a hump until they could get proper care. So
right.
it's so important. It's not just one thing as you see it and I see it. As it's multiple things, but it's got to be taken seriously, because none of us want to see that person crippled or in a wheelchair for the rest of their life when they could possibly turn their life around with the right antidote at the time.
Yeah, and one thing too, mercury, if the patient has high levels of mercury, possibly from mercury fillings or excessive seafood, then the yeast problem is not going to go away. They need to get that mercury cleared out, or they keep the yeast, as you know, the candidiasis.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's a total detox. I mean, we don't just do silicone detox. We look at heavy metals and look at the total toxic load. And I do think that, you know, once you have something in your body like a leaking silicone implant, if you're not on extra things like glutathione and things to help both phases of intracellular detoxification, you're going to, you know, quickly form a lot of free radicals. And forming free radicals is what breaks down into cancer and damages vessels and makes you age. So
right.
It's not good. You need to have plenty of glutathione, that's what we recommend.
Right. And with glutathione, too, there's, you know, the enzyme, which they call glutathione S transferase, but that S is for sulfur. It has a little bit of sulfur. And sometimes with different exposures, you'll smell like a sulfur from your body or an odor from your body. You're thinking it's the toxin, et cetera, and more than likely it is, but it's also this enzyme being used that if you don't have enough sulfur, you can't get your glutathione to work in that, especially if you've gone through a trauma like a ruptured implant and I would even say that anyone that has this type of technology in their body, they should reconsider having their house sprayed for bugs or anything, because that's going to weaken the immune system, not only of the people living there, but also them in particular, because of what we've seen with the early studies that even FDA had, their immune system would be compromised or interact upon exposures.
Yeah, one of the things we test through applied kinesiology, all of the patients with is whether or not they need MSM, and that'll help bring the sulfur group back in for that enzyme. So some people do, some people don't. It just depends on their genetics and all sorts of other things, their diet.
Right, and what kind of feet they have. I did a study with Annie Choi over a year ago, and we found that Roman feet went all the way to Korea. Because they were trading in the ginseng. But the thing is that over time, when you look at the genetics, you find out if you can metabolize certain thiols or mercaptans or anything. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they accumulate in your body and set you up. Like O blood individuals are more susceptible to right area glaucoma, you know, where the sclera will swell up on the right corner of the eye versus, you know, the whole eye swelling up. And it's the amount of mercaptans and thiols that are in the body that are bound. And this, I just want to share, is people always think, well, we've got mutation. Yes, chemicals can cause mutations, and it can cause a mutation in, right now, your life exposure to radiation. But if you have a chemical that does not allow the radiation, a radioactive particle, to go through, or it's the particles with another component, say a polymer or anything, it allows it to stay in your body, and thus longer, fastest mutation is from radiation, then chemicals, and then viruses. But the thing is, with all of it, it's where viruses or the chemicals can go into the cell or be on the cell membrane, and then as you duplicate those cells, those little bit of toxin can be in those, versus if the toxin got into the eggs or into the developing child's reproductive system. Thus, it can go on for another generation. I'm going to call it generational mutation or change that way. And this is so important in this. When I had Dr. Singla, who does stem cell work, and I know that's the new trend in going into adipose stem cell therapies once they're approved from FDA, that these new little cells can also contain a toxin, as I have found in my career, that fat absorbs lipophilic compounds. Compounds that love fat will go there. And the body can't get rid of these compounds until the body can make them water soluble. And that's why you need your glutathione and all these other enzymes and a good, healthy GI tract so that it can clean out and make the protective enzymes from your natural microflora. But the thing is, where I'm going with this, Dr. Kolb, and thank you for your patience, is that a lot of testing needs to be done, because a lot of, even doing these fat transfers, you know, that you may be exposed and not realize it, that the fat that you may have put in your breast area may be accumulated with the pesticide that you used in your house and you didn't know. Because
right.
I used to do so many cases or anything where we'd take adipose tissue from the Botox and end up having it extremely high in the area for the compounds that we were looking for, where it wasn't in peripheral blood or anything. So
yeah.
What I found in all of this, a lot of people don't have that even tested or washed, you know, to get it out, the chemicals. So.
And there is a question with stem cell fat transfer if that's going to increase the risk of breast cancer. And so you're right. If say there's a certain chemical that you preferentially put in your lower abdomen,
mm-hmm.
and you then take the fat out of there and put it in the breast, the question is, will that chemical increase the risk of cancer in the breast?
And it
and
could.
That's why we're having FDA trials. Now,
mm-hmm.
you know, the FDA trials are just going to go on for a couple of years, and as you know, that may not be long enough to assess the cancer risk, so...
Right, and it's a simple fix, too. All they need to do is take that sample of that fat, adipose, just do a little, I call it like a little split sample. You don't even need, you need a, like 1 milligram, one little drop size, just to see if it has chemical on it, pesticides or anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if it was scanned with a Raman, just to see so that they'd have that in the data banks, you know. It's...
Mm-hmm.
A whole new area that could easily be done without doing any harm, but at the same time, and I'm also, I say chemicals all the time, but even scanning for viruses, I have found people that have had a very bad infection of measles when they were a child, their titers are like sky high, like 1 to 320, when a positive is 1 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is that you might have a tremendous viral load that you were exposed to. Yes, you got great immunity and stuff like that for that particular disease or disorder. But the thing is that if you're using your fat, it may cause another problem, you know, that
it could.
You don't know.
Well, you know, we don't know a whole bunch about what's out there. You know that. I mean, we
mm-hmm.
have no idea what happens. I know that the FDA has suggested that you use MRIs to detect implant leakage, when in fact it really won't detect leakage. It might detect rupture, although there's a 15% false positive. But certainly, Dr. Blaze told one of my patients the other day, I haven't had a chance to talk to Dr. Blaze about this, but he said that the platinum and the gadolinium react with one another. So he doesn't recommend anybody with breast implants getting that might have platinum in them getting a gadolinium MRI scan. So, I mean, look at that. Who would think that those two things would react?
Right,
probably just
right.
A toxicologist would think of that.
And watch those Argyle diamonds in there. We'll continue that on our next half, okay? We're going to take a little break and be right
mm-hmm.
back.
Thank you.
Welcome back, audience, to the One Cell, One Light radio show with our guest, Dr. Susan Kolb of Plastiques in Atlanta, Georgia, that we're discussing silicone breast implants. And on our first half, we were just leaving the issue of platinum and how toxic it is from the implants. And I wanted to share with you, Dr. Kolb, in the older formulations, I don't know if this is still going on with the formulations, in particular when the Dow Corning was going on in the trials and everything, it was found that in the making of the silicone gel that they used this particular silicone oil, and in that oil they had a compound called chloroplatininic, P-L-A-T-I-N-I-C acid, and what would happen is when that would react with the benzyl peroxide aspect of that formulation, what would happen is it would make large amounts of cis platinum.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting
a chemotherapy agent.
Right, that's what I was going to tell you. It was a chemotherapy agent that they were blending in this for antimicrobial or whatever they were doing agent that way. So I wonder if one is the regular application of platinum versus a chemical like this chemotherapy agent added to it that. Because it had the chlorine molecule, it may have been more reactive because of the halogens, the way halogens work with the body that way. So time will tell as we do more of these advanced studies and find out the history of that way.
Well, I can tell you this, Hildy. There is a four times less risk of breast cancer if you have silicone implants. And pressure is one aspect of that. Cancer does not form as well with pressure. In fact, if you have fibrocystic disease, it usually goes away when you put implants in, but it can come back when you take implants out. And as you know, fibrocystic disease sometimes is the precursor of cancer because mm-hmm. of its chemical toxicity issues. And the other thing is silica. I think silica in itself helps prevent cancer. And then the third one is all of the cytokines. Tumor necrosis factor is a cytokine. But now I think I'm going to add that cisplatinum is a fifth thing.
Yeah, but that's the breakdown from chloroplatinic, P-L-A-T-I-N-I-C, acid.
Yeah.
Which was
well,
used
that might
in
prevent
it.
Cancer, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's
turn,
a chemotherapy agent and anti-tumorigenic.
Yeah.
So we will find out through your studies, okay?
Yeah.
Now, I know I've had to evaluate individuals that had ruptured breast implants, and sometimes they are so devastating because the implant material runs like a river through the internal organs, and it even when the person sweats or perspires or just oozes out of the tissue, you know, that way. Have you participated in any studies or anything or have any knowledge of when that material, like, oozes out of the skin, did anyone ever test it or anything to see if it was silicone? It could have other things in it, but...
Well, we haven't tested anything, but what I see is these lesions that form that gritty stuff comes out of,
mm-hmm.
and it's like sand. So I imagine it's actually silica
mm-hmm.
that comes
mm-hmm.
out. And then there was a study done where there were silica crystals around a nerve, that somebody had a nerve biopsy, and there was silica crystals around the nerve with a ruptured silicone implant. And the nerve was in the leg. So
it migrated
that
far.
Yeah, and then I did take off a lesion on a patient's back one time and found a little ball of silicone in the lesion. So... that was interesting. It must have gotten there somehow.
Right. And I could see how this type of material would migrate to areas where there's more electrical, like a nerve or anything, because it's being attracted to that, you know, but due to its own charge. And I could see where it accumulates that way. Now, with any of this, have you seen the interaction, you know, like in certain rural areas you might have iron water, you know, more minerals or sulfur water or different waters, and you don't have them filtered or anything. If someone was to have an implant, have you seen any reaction that way? Of them being
no,
more...
but I haven't taken that history, so I don't know about it. I know that magnesium deficiency is very prevalent among women with, you know, ruptured implants.
Very
so,
interesting, because magnesium is
that.
Needed. Magnesium is needed to help vitamin B6 work, and vitamin B6, when you're deficient of it, you have a lot of pain. So very interesting, that aspect of deficiency of magnesium.
And yeah, and they have a Krebs cycle problem, too. I'm sure you're aware of that, that they go into anaerobic metabolism but not aerobic metabolism. So, say, I went out one day and played tennis, and I was fine when I was playing tennis, but, you know, for the next 3 days I could hardly move. It's like, I mean, it's not good.
Right, right. Interesting how the body does that too. You know, switches from one to another when it's lacking oxygen, but still going forward to survive.
Right.
That way, goes back to our ancestors. But in any of the use of it, was there any other symptoms besides, you know, the immunological or anything? Did they lose hair or anything? Because I'm looking at with mineral deficiency of magnesium and possibly even interaction with their own silica that is needed in their body, that it might cause loss of hair or other types of factors. But I personally haven't heard that.
Well, almost every patient who's ill from their implants has hair loss, and you can correct that primarily by replacing thyroid. I believe that just about everybody eventually gets yeast and mold to the degree that they get the sick building syndrome or biotoxin syndrome. And Dr. Shoemaker's diagram shows that leptin receptors are damaged in the hypothalamus, and that causes a complete endocrinopathy. You know, you have adrenal problems, thyroid problems, sex hormone problems, and you drink and pee all the time because you don't have ADH. Now, one very interesting thing in surgery, when they are really, really depleted in ADH, they will bleed in surgery. We don't know exactly what it is. It kind of looks like a platelet problem, but if you give them desmopressin, which is ADH, and we have it here in the center, then within 20 minutes, the bleeding stops. So I can tell you that the endocrine disruption of the ADH, which is really pituitary, could get one in big trouble during a surgery if you didn't know that you had to replace it.
Right. Yeah, they'd have very bad problems. Have you, from any of these ruptures or anything, because as a toxicologist, there's many different latency periods from like one-time exposure or a significant exposure to a certain compound. Example, like chromium can cause lung cancer 20 to 25 years later from that initial exposure, if everything is susceptible, versus radium, bone sarcoma, 23 years later, and nickel, lung cancer 24 again, versus asbestos, you know, it can be as long as 30 or 37 years later. I have not studied, you know, the silicone, you know, latency period or anything. I know that it uses a lot of oxygen, so it's proportional to the loss of oxygen, too. Have you pursued any of that aspect?
I can tell you when people get sick, because, of course, as you mentioned earlier, trauma happens. I mean, people fall on their implants, they get kicked, they get in car wrecks, especially the left breast implant will get ruptured in a car wreck because of the seatbelt, or they just get a closed capsular contracture, or, you know, release from the surgeon where he squeezes the implant. They don't do that anymore, but they used to squeeze the implant and then rupture it. And pretty much within 2 weeks, the patients are pretty sick. So I would say about 2 weeks. So from the time that the implant, the gel gets out of the implant to where the patient is pretty much on their way to a chronic illness where they need to stay in the bed 14 to 17 hours a day.
Right. And that is a long time, too, of recuperating, too, when they're in the bed that long. And for it could even be weeks to months in that situation. In this migration of silicone or any of that aspect, I do know that organs have different charges on them, and silicone has always been associated with migrating to reproductive organs in women, let alone the breast, but also the uterus and that area. Have you in any of your patients or evaluations seen more of uterine or ovary inflammations or anything after a ruptured implant?
I always wondered about uterine fibroids because, of course, silicone has an estrogenic quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that uterine fibroids have that estrogen thing that makes them grow. So I thought maybe, I know I had a large uterine fibroid that actually I got to go away with some very interesting things like psychic surgery. But it certainly, I wondered whether or not I was prone to that because of the silicone leaking out. I don't know. A lot of, you know, so many women have uterine fibroids, it's kind of hard to know if they just have it or if they have it because of the silicone.
Right, you don't know, but the whole thing too, audience and Dr. Gull, is the toxins. If it's allowed to accumulate in your body, and you're not taking an appropriate, not even detox, but preventive areas that way of supplementing your glutathione or any of these other strong antioxidant materials, your body does get weaker. That temple does get a little erosion. And once it's changed, though, many factors can help in eliminating and getting these materials out. The hard thing, though, I've seen is just as the standard onion theory, which is you have to take each layer off at a time, with the more chemicals that are more fat-soluble, where they go into the tissue or the body will wall in with protein or send out more fat using cholesterol and triglycerides, as those compounds break down with the fat and the chemical in it, you can have very similar, if not the same, reactions that you had initially of when you were exposed because of those toxic elements there.
That's true. I have a question for you. With all these women getting MRI tests, either for breast implants or for other things, we see on the hair analysis huge levels of gadolinium. And then we see some gadolinium toxicity as well. The question is, how do you get gadolinium out?
Gadolinium would come out just as like with heavy metals, the more chlorella, cilantro, those types, the more, I'm going to say, aromatic of the green vegetables or the sea vegetables. Kelp
okay.
is excellent, in particular black kelp is excellent in pulling it out because it helps with the metabolic processes. But these new dyes that are using the gadolinium, they also have in some of them, so they get better pictures, you know, colored imagery, and it's not thermo colors, it's the actual dyes in that. They use quantum dots or nanoparticles in it. And so you do need something to help absorb those materials, because those materials, when it gets on the surface of the cell, it not only takes excellent pictures, but it is more likely to get into the membrane and then interfere with the copper, the sodium, the magnesium, you know, all of those electrolytes that are needed to keep the balance of the equilibrium of the cell.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome, but it's all of the above that you've been recommending, plus a little bit more. I tell you, too, because different clays, you know, we've all started with green clay, the red clays, the yellow clays, et cetera. There should be a potpourri of different clays, because sometimes you need just a little bit of the clay with the greens, like the chlorella or the kelps, to help it. And even horseradish, wasabi, we do a beautiful blend called Monkey King Blend, and that just needs that little push of that little natural SOD to help things go so it can get out of the membranes. But definitely that way, because the more, and it's just logic, if it's smaller, it can get into the surface, you know, into the pores faster. And thus, what happens is the body will send out, especially if that area turns acid in composition, it will send out little particles of calcium trying to neutralize it. And in that process, it gets calcified there, and it can make a cyst, or it can do its normal things or that way. But it can cause calcium deposits, too, over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that brings up another point, that when you're detoxing from anything, but particularly from chemical toxicity from silicon, because there's so much chemical, you need to maintain alkalinity for things to go smoother.
Correct. And people think, you know, well, we've got to do the water, we've got to do that. Yes, you do. But even if you took a bath in kelp or any of this to maintain some alkalinity, change your diet, eat more cabbage, any of these types of foods, beets or anything that have more alkaline in nature, will assist that way. I also tell our patients here or clients that when you can't get anything to detox, remember two things. One, get a can of sauerkraut, because it's got enough sulfur and it can detoxify the intestinal colon, worst case, okay, when you don't know what to do. And then always get saute some mushrooms, even though they're a fungus, but they have so many enzymes and so many nutrients that can help you when you're trying to seek help in the interim. So...
Yep.
That's like the first aid kit, you know.
That's a great idea. We came across alkaline water tubes, which we sell for about $20. They're a tube that you can put in a gallon of distilled water, and it'll take the pH up to 11.
Oh,
and in regular water, I mean, well, in like filtered water, it goes up to about 9. I wouldn't put it in tap water, because you don't really need to be drinking tap water. But essentially, that really has helped people become more alkaline, and it's good for like 720 liters of water. So that's a good way to do alkalinity.
Excellent. And it's handy if it's in those tubes or anything, not only for the gallon. Can they put it into like their water bottle or something too?
They can, but I have a problem just with bacterial contamination with them drinking out of it, because you don't want to contaminate the water tube, you know, the actual tube. So I tell them to put it in another gallon somewhere else and then pour water into their water bottle from that, so that they maintain sterility, you know, because things can grow in water. And
yeah, they do.
Enough people have gotten sick because they don't clean their water bottles, you know.
Yeah, and we know how non-circulating lakes and streams, streams are circulating, but, you know, those water sources can grow those little amoebas and everything like that.
Yeah,
so
almost anything can grow in water, so you got to be careful.
Yeah, you got to be careful that way. The other thing is, with any of the whether it's the new implants or the old implants or anything like that, this is just a general question because I know the body can make aldehydes from just the process of trying to neutralize a toxin in the body, you know, and stimulating the glutathione. Do these people have more calluses, like on their feet or on their hands, than one that did not have a ruptured implant or possibly one that just has an implant?
You know, I can't answer that question. I haven't looked.
Something
I
for the future.
I can do that for the future.
Yeah,
They do have the lipomas. You know, I've seen lipomas that are gigantic and multiple. And I really think that, I know one time Dr. Fing is the other surgeon in the country that does a lot of explants, and I went up to her one day at one of the FDA meetings, and I said, "Hey, Dr. Fing, I said, do you see a bunch of patients with all these lipomas?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Why do you think that is?" And she just looks at me. She said, she didn't know. And I said, "Well, it's probably the platinum. You know, there's a reason." But she was seeing it too. Is the point that because a lot of times when people have lipomas, they ask their plastic surgeon to remove it because it's annoying, you know. And if you have surgery anyway, they're going to want to get that lipoma off. And if it has platinum in it, it's probably a pretty good idea. Just take it away.
For the long-term effects, definitely. The other thing with implants, is there any concern? Because we know that they possibly, the chemicals alone can cause some type of endocrine disruption or interact with it. Is there concern to be on certain birth control pills or anything like that for a female that may react with the implant or increase the risk of breast cancer?
With birth control pills specifically?
Yeah, example like with DES or any of those type that already had a history of increasing the risk of cancer in women, but if they had a breast implant or in particular the rupture of it, have you seen any studies or anything that shows that they're more at higher risk?
No, pretty much you can forget studies. They're not funded by anybody.
Yeah, not anymore. Not anymore.
we can discuss the politics of that, but you're not going to see studies other than, you know, the implant company sponsored studies, which are all about safety for the FDA. Just about everything else is, there was a little bit, I mean, Dr. Campbell did some studies and Dr. Browner did some studies and Dr. Shanklin and Smalley did some studies, but those were all right around the early 90s, but it's pretty much off limits now to question, you know, the safety of implants.
Right, and I know Dr. Lape, when he was reviewing some of the presentations that he did with the studies with Dow Corning early on, this is in the late 70s, early 80s, the interesting thing, and it was like a joke, but it was serious, is that the rats that were selected for the studies were male rats, and thus if you injected it with, say, like dioxin, the female rats would have gotten liver cancer, but the male rats didn't. So it was interesting that it's a augmentation process of implants that are mainly used in females, but in the selection of the animal studies, they used male rats instead of female rats.
Yeah, so the estrogen was lacking. But I think you're right in questioning along those lines, because the silicone itself is estrogenic. In other words, it acts as an estrogen in at least some pathways in the body. So too much estrogen, especially the dangerous kinds of estrogen, definitely can increase the risk of cancer. Now, you would think that would be breast cancer, but we don't see that. And we talked earlier about why we don't see that. So it's confusing. You know, you've got these factors that increase the risk of breast cancer and maybe these factors that decrease it. So, but you could look at ovarian cancer. You could look at, you know, another organ.
Right.
Didn't have the pressure and They might still have the cytokines and the silica, though. So maybe it balances out. I don't know. Maybe the hormonal effect balances out the tumor necrosis factor and the silica factor.
Mm-hmm. I know many of the individuals would experience, chronic headaches, increased fatigue, as we discussed, swollen lymph nodes, acid-like burning in their body areas, hair loss, and that. But one of the symptoms that was brought out in the early studies of Kosofsky was also ringing in the ears. And I wanted to, an unusual smell in the urine, which is basically the plastic coming out, which can cause different odors, because the plastic reacts with an enzyme, monooxygenase, in our body, and squalene comes out, and it has a very funky smell. It smells horrible. But the ringing in the ears, because why I'm interested in that is because in some of the formulations of the silicon with the gel, they used an ammonium compound with it to make like a hydrogel of it, meaning to aerate it, make it come out. And ammonia, when it gets on the 8th and 9th peripheral nerve, because it takes the arginine out of the body and the ornithine, it can cause ringing in the ear. So I wonder if I don't think anyone's ever tested ammonia levels in individuals.
Yeah, many patients have ringing in their ears. And so what would you suggest, doing an ammonia level then?
Yeah, ammonia level I would, because then if the ammonia is not supposed to be in the blood, period, you know?
Right.
So something's not working right. Either you're not making your methylhistidine properly, you're making your B vitamins, or something's taking out your B vitamins, and it's the ammonia is the breakdown product of whatever the gel may be, you know, that has an ammonium ion with it, compound with it. But the thing is that if it is the L-arginine and the ornithine lost as a result of the ammonia, if you take that supplement and balance the system back, you wouldn't have ringing in the ears.
Right. Well, we could try it on people.
Yeah, that's all. But I think, and a lot of them suffered, I know, with dizziness. Like if you got up fast, they became dizzy, you know, when they got out of a chair or anything. And a lot of that I found, I don't know if you agree or have seen it too, is that they have less oxygen as a result of the chemicals being in their circulatory blood or impacting some type of release of the oxygen within the body. You said it yourself. You went anaerobic, versus that way.
Well, the statistics that I ran with it of the silicone patients that were ruptured or leaking, 82% had those neurological problems with vertigo. And I remember I used to turn my head to the side and the room would spin. So, which is hard during surgery because sometimes you have to turn your head to the side.
Yeah, real fast. Yeah,
but it went away after the explant. And I did a bunch of different detox too. I always figured it was just chemical, chemically a neurotoxin. It could be just a neurotoxin. I mean.
Right, because it does go there. Now, many individuals do have mammograms. In your experience, do you recommend them when someone has an implant?
Not if the implant's older, because you can take out an older implant and just squeeze it just a tiny bit and it'll rupture. The shell gets very, very soft. So no, not older implants. You can get a thermogram if you're worried about cancer. There's a study that just recently came out of Europe showing that breast ultrasounds, if the radiologists know what they're looking at, are just as good as mammograms for cancer detection. And then you have MRIs too, but you might not want to do the MRI with gadolinium because the reaction with platinum.
Right. Just do no contrast, no dye, and then they should be safe that way. Because I know a lot of times with the cramping and the crushing of the breast, it does do trauma on a regular breast versus having an implant in it.
Oh, rupture is common during mammography. I mean, I see it all the time. The patient hears a pop during the mammography and gets sick 2 weeks later. And we talked about that earlier. It takes about 2 weeks.
To feel it, because it takes new blood 7 to 10 days. So that's probably in relation to that.
Right.
And then it goes to those organs in 0 to 3 months accumulation. Now, with your center, I have not discussed with you. Please explain your center and what you do there, because I know patients come from all over the world and the United States to get assistance from you, either surgery or the protocols to remove the silicone or any of those aspects.
Yes, we have our own operating rooms here, and for longer surgeries, I use my partner, Dr. Gordon. He does one side. I do one side. That helps decrease the operative time, which is good. And we have MD Anesthesia. We have the Kennestone Group. They're a hospital group. They're very, very good. They've been with us many years, and they know exactly what to do to keep people safe. I can say, knocking on wood, that we've never even cracked the crash cart here once, and we've been in business since 95, which is fairly remarkable if you think about it. And we're JCO Certified Surgery Center, which is the highest level of safety. I was the first JCO Certified plastic surgery center in Georgia. In 1999, they came and did a 3-day inspection. It was the same as a hospital inspection, because I didn't do office inspections then. And I got 99 out of 100, and they asked me to be a JCO inspector. So I think they thought my center was pretty safe. And
since then,
the inspectors have constantly told me every 3 years we get inspected, and they've all said that they would have surgery here, which is probably one of the highest compliments that they give somebody. So
excellent.
I think, and I've had surgery here at least 6 times that I know of, so maybe a little bit more if you consider the minor things, and but generally anesthesia, and I feel that it's a safe center, and we do know what we're doing. People should be careful who they go to, especially if they're going into the armpit to get out lymph nodes. It takes somebody who's does this fairly often to do it safely. There's a lot of vessels and nerves in the armpit, and you need to know what you're doing. And then, of course, if you want implants back in, we can tell you what are the safest. The majority of people will not want anything put back in and are waiting, if they want anything, are waiting for stem cell fat transfer. But some of the reconstruction patients, still want to have a reconstruction. So we can help them with that, whether it be tissue transfer. Dr. Gordon did a fellowship in breast and microvascular surgery at Sloan Kettering, so he's kind of an expert at breast reconstruction after cancer. So all of these things are possible here. We've got Dr. Gould is my holistic family practice doctor who understands silicone toxicity very well. And, he can see, he takes almost every insurance there is, so you can see him as a family practice doctor who understands silicone toxicity, which is very important, because, of course, there's so many symptoms. Most patients have at least 30 different symptoms, and if you take that to a regular family practice doctor, they throw up their hands and try to put you on an SSRI inhibitor or send you to a psychiatrist. They can't handle the 30 symptoms. Don't know what to do with it.
Right. Now, with your center, do they do it as it's outpatient? Is that correct? Or do they stay in and then they have local hotel or something that takes them to the center after surgery?
Yeah.
That's good.
We try to keep the patient out of the hospital because of the risk of infection.
Correct, correct.
C. diff has become really bad in hospitals. I don't know if you know that, but many of my patients who get hospitalized for other things end up getting C. diff. So And there's, of course, bad staff infections, too, in hospitals. So
right.
we try to keep the patient out of the hospital. If the patient has an insurance that requires them to be done at the hospital, Dr. Gordon can take them up to the hospital and do them here. He is, you know, he's on staff at North Fulton Hospital. And so we can accommodate that. But we try to do them outside of the hospital.
Right. And I want to bring out in your book, which is The Naked Truth About Breast Implants from Harm to Healing, audience, it's a wonderful book. And the nice thing, too, not only did you cover the history of implants, give some case studies, give the different types, meaning the silicone versus the saline implant. But you also bring out, which you said earlier, your intuition, you bring out the spiritual meaning of disease, which is very nice because it so many people need that now so that they can heal and let go of what the trauma has been to their body.
Yeah, it doesn't help a great deal to stay in a victim mentality. You know, a lot of the women fell into that in the 90s, and it probably didn't work real well. What's much better is to go into a more intuitive mode where you attract to you the practitioners and the knowledge and the, you know, the supplements and the things where you get educated as to what you can do to get better. And so the majority of people who come here have been praying for a solution, or their family members have been, you know, looking for them on the internet, or even their doctors sometimes look for them and find our information and realize that we probably have the tools to help them get better because we treat holistically, which means we treat everything. You know, we
right.
treat the immune system, the endocrine system, the metabolic system. We do the surgery. We do the, you know, the diet and exercise, and we realize that they don't have aerobic metabolism yet, so we're not going to tell them to go out and exercise because that's not going to work well.
yeah.
Until you fix that, it's just not going to work.
Right.
So, yeah, we have a more holistic approach, and that's, you know, that's what's needed.
And you care about your patients. I know several of your patients have crossed my path and vice versa, and it's well received by the patients, your whole approach and your caring and the nurturing that they have at your facilities and afterwards. It's well received and well respected in the community and within their families and that. It's thank you very much for having your abilities and your gifts and giving them to this world, because it's so needed.
Well, thank you for helping me.
well, we're here together on this lifetime,
that's
so
right.
we're gonna do it. And it's like years ago when I got involved with breast implants with the Dow Corning and all that was through Miss Pamela Kendall, and she wrote a fantastic book too, which was Torn Illusions. And her experience of what happened when her breast implant ruptured, which were those thinner types, it literally came out of her pores, down her whole outfit,
oh, yeah.
everything.
Runny,
it was absolutely horrible what happened to her
right.
in those times. And through her early efforts and making the awareness, and as you said, PJ and others, trying to make the change because they went through so much. I like to think that we think of them and appreciate their contribution, because I know if it wasn't Ms. Kendall, I wouldn't have been involved with it. So it was where she crossed my path out of the need for knowing the toxic effects of it, and
right.
the rest was history. That
right.
one.
There's another book out. I don't know if you've read it, but you may want to have Gail Hamilton on your show. It's very, very amazing book. She wrote a book called The DIRT Committee, D-I-R-T Committee. And it's a book about the committee at Dow Corning that was formed to go through all of the memos and documents and clean them out of anything damaging regarding implants. But of course, they had so much that they didn't get everything out. So she wrote a whole book on what they found when they went into those warehouses where they just filled them up with all those documents, you know, during the settlement lawsuits, and what they found. And just an example, Dow Corning was telling all of the physicians and the public that silicone was inert at the same time that Dow Chemical was using it to kill cockroaches. And I don't know whether you know about cockroaches, but nothing kills cockroaches. Well, evidently silicone does pretty well.
Yeah, yeah, they probably suffocated it. It probably cut up their stomach if it was the dirt, you know. But that's a very good point.
Isn't that
I've been
great?
Asked many questions on a deposition. It's inert. It's got a high melting point. You know?
Yeah, well, then how come you were using it to kill cockroaches successfully?
Yeah, and silicon dioxide, which is dirt, is, you know,
right.
Makes up the
right.
whole surface of the earth, you know.
Right, yeah.
And
yeah.
I go, yeah, but... It doesn't have
well,
the oil in it. It doesn't have this.
Right.
Are you talking
yeah,
silicon?
Right.
S-I-L-O-N-E or O-N? You know, has it got the quartz? You know, it might have copper in it. Who knows?
Well, the thing that gets to me is how they think that, okay, they're going to put a substance in the body. Let's call it platinum, and it's a platinum oxidized right. compound, and they just assume the body isn't going to change it into anything else. That's just ignorance.
That's
the body
true.
Changes silicone, which is a plastic, into silica that coats nerves or comes out through the skin. I mean, it can change a platinum compound into something more toxic.
Right, because its ultimate goal in detoxification is, if I can't handle it...
Break it down.
Break it down. If I can't make it from fat-soluble to water-soluble, then I got to save it because I might have to use it as food or something in the future, you know?
Right.
As I've said many times, our bodies or our souls must have starved very long and hard because we want to save everything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
But it's so true, Dr. Kolb. It is that it just amazes me. You know, the thought, and they have such beautiful laboratories and everything. It's I know I had one time I had a review data of a chemical company. It had nothing to do with what we're talking about, but they made this one compound, and it was in a isocyanate family. And what that means, audience and Dr. Kolb, is that it has a very low melting point, meaning of 72 degrees Fahrenheit. So when you're in hot, humid weather of 100% humidity, it is a toxic gas when it's all gassing in a
right.
greenhouse or anything.
Right.
And it said that right on their data. So I was at a meeting with the Department of Agriculture, and I said, it's right there. They're just not interpreting their own data. So that was a great experience of my life during that time. But
right.
I thought, it's there, but it's the matter of the interpretation and seeing it, you know, or not seeing it.
Well, the companies are biased. I mean, by definition, they're biased. And so, you know, the idea that the FDA allows the companies to do the research to prove the safety of the substances or the implants is crazy. I mean, we need, as I said in my book, I have a whole section on this, we need to have, you know, the companies donate money to a third party that cannot be influenced to do the testing. I mean,
right,
that's just
right.
common sense.
Yeah, and apply for it because, and also you'd have to even watch, even if that third party, it might even be a separate company or a physician or whatever on it because so many now with the universities, even though that we've all come from a university or that type of scenario, that there's going to be a great conflict, I feel, in the future because there's so much IP being generated at universities under joint collaborative research with mm-hmm. companies as a whole that it's going to be interesting in the future, the new laws, as I call it, that will be challenged.
Well, it's all about ethics. I mean, it's
mm-hmm.
all about having unbiased researchers and unbiased people interpreting the research. As you just pointed out, somebody can look at something and totally miss the fact that it is a gas at that temperature. So,
right.
You know, you have to interpret the research as well, the research results. And I did endocrine research in Hopkins and at WashU, and I knew very well because I designed studies that if I knew enough about what I was designing the study for, if I knew enough of the variables, I could make it come out in all sorts of different ways. You know,
mm-hmm.
if I designed the study a certain way, and I think this is what happens. I think that they want a certain result, so they did not design the study so that they get that result.
Well, as it was brought out in Torn Illusions, their book, that they Dow Quinn selected male rats for the study
right.
instead of female rats. So, mm-hmm. great comparison. But we do know, and it's sad, and it's all due to these endocrine disruptors and everything that's happened, where our whole bodies are getting exposed to so many toxins, even in the air and in the environment and radiation, everything now, that even males now are experiencing breast cancer where they didn't have that before.
There's a great example of that in the literature where, I don't think they did a study, but this was an article that I read on a number of Marines that were swimming in Lake Lejeune got breast cancer, and it was found that Lake Lejeune was a toxic chemical dump
mm-hmm.
for a while. And so in the military, you know, you have really good records in the military.
Excellent
because,
records, yeah.
Yeah, so, and then you also know what toxic exposure they had because, you know, they were at Camp Lejeune. So, and male breast cancer is rare enough that if you get a rash of breast cancer in men, you can probably, you know, put it back to a certain source. And I'm not sure politically what happened with that. I'm not sure that they did anything, like say, don't go swimming in the lake. We can hope that they did, but...
Right. I know it gets political and then it gets buried over time. Not that the problem's
mm-hmm.
gone away. It's still there and it's going now into a second generation. So it's
right.
even probably more problems. I just want to touch on it. It is related in a way to implants as a whole versus specifically female breast implants. Thing is, have you experienced anything or any patients that may have had cheek implants, you know, which are harder plastic that are put in the cheek
mm-hmm.
to build up the cheekbone, or many males, which I didn't realize until I was working out here in California, in the LA area, that many males, some of them have pictorial implants, you know, which is like
right.
hard plastic to make them look like they worked out and got a six-pack, but it's up in the upper pictorial muscle area.
Have you had any effects from them?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, we have. You know, there's testicular implants, penile implants, gluteal implants. There's even little implants they put in your tear ducts if you have dry eyes. There's pectoral implants and calf implants for men. And so these are usually slabs of silicone rather than gel. So they're harder silicone. The people generally that have problems with this with these implants have the HLA types, you know, the HLA B27s
uh-huh.
Or DR53s. They're going to react right away, usually within a week or two. They're going to get sick with a kind of an autoimmune type thing. And or the other thing that can happen is if the implant gets infected with the biofilm around it,
right.
you can get the
right.
thick building syndrome. But that usually that may happen right away, or it may happen within exposure years later. Like we said, if you breathe in a lot of mold, it can land on an implant. And so removing the implants usually is curative, treating with some antifungals, doing a little silicone and maybe chemical detox if they need it. That's usually pretty easy to get them over that. But, yes, the silicone, all of those silicone implants we see problems with. And the worst one, and I'm sure you've had these people call you, are the injected silicones.
Oh yes.
Silicone
or
parties
even,
in the hotel.
Yeah, even that. I mean, and the use of in these injection parties, or even there was cases out here where professional physician used technical grade silicone, which is, you know, industrial silicone gel that you use to put on your transmission, as I call it,
right.
Versus
right.
You know, medical grade without the other impurities in it, and was injecting it into the lips of ladies out here. So
yeah,
right. There is, audience, we're, Dr. Carbonara is sharing that there is so much with just the regular medicinal grade use of it and the factors that could possibly interact with your body and cause harm to you, let alone don't participate or wouldn't participate in these injection parties or anything like that. Even people have died because they injected so much of this silicone into them that it suffocated them.
Yeah, it got in the bloodstream and went into their lungs. And a large number of people have died. It's not that rare. It's certain, and we want to mention it's illegal to do this in all states, so it's illegal to inject silicone. And, you know, I always pointed out to people, well, if it's illegal to inject silicone because it's so dangerous, how come it's okay to have a ruptured implant in your body, you know?
Oh, very good point.
That.
Very good point.
Yeah, but,
very
you know,
good point. Very good.
So,
now,
yeah, so we need to get together to form a, because I don't really have one. We need to collaborate to get a protocol for these injection patients. I mean, I use some of the stuff I use for my other ones, but, you know, they do have some different chemicals in them. They do have... I think they have chemicals that are more carcinogenic.
They have more of, excuse me for interrupting you, more of these, you know, these technical grade silicone gels or anything.
Mm-hmm.
They have more of the halogenated solvents like trichloroethylene,
right.
Any of these. And those, perchloroethylene, that are known to cause cancer or any of that because of the chlorination. Yeah.
We do, yeah.
Yeah. And,
but I think we need a special protocol for them because of the additive chemicals. And I just want to make a point that the PIP implants, PIP implants in Europe, which, of course, the silicone PIPs here were never even put on the market, but the PIPs had a non-medical grade silicone in them too. And one of the components melted the shell a lot quicker, so it would rupture quicker.
Right, and because... I wrote that book a long time ago, Hazardous Materials. In there is the compatibility of different plastics. I'm just putting, you know, latex, silicone, et cetera, this way, because different solvents would react with it and cause it to melt faster. So,
right.
Very interesting. Because those PIPs were not only used in Europe, but weren't they the ones that were used in Brazil?
Yes.
Or that area? Yeah, South America.
I was contacted by somebody who is from Brazil who asked me to come down to Brazil to help deal with the massive epidemic they have down there of sick people. I mean, sick women especially. I mean, it's significant. And you know, in Europe it is too. You know, a lot of the socialized countries are having to pay to remove these implants, you know, with socialized medicine. So
right.
At least they have socialized medicine to remove them. We don't have that in the U.S. So.
No. And what I am surprised, I know you tell your patients, you know, every 10 years, but so many people that have the implants, I had a person that came to our office for total toxin exposure, but then was sharing with me, she was in her 60s, but she had implants when she was 19, done in Switzerland, and never had them removed. And I told her that she needed definitely to talk to, like, yourself or to other plastic surgeons that remove this, because If she had no ill health effect or anything, because it's been so long in there, it may have been totally encapsulated in there. It needs to be thoroughly evaluated before even possibly removing it, because it's, I don't know if it's the right answer, but meaning some cases maybe it needs to just stay, if, you know, because I thought, well, my word, she might even have the urethane one, you know, so who knows, you know. Because I didn't know what Switzerland was doing at that time, some 40 years ago. But the whole thing is that with any type of device that's put into the body, it is important that the person that has to is using that either for beauty or for its own medicinal purpose, evaluate it, know what the risks are, and ask those questions of that physician and that staff, and also know if you're in a clinical study of those types of prosthetics or those types of implants, that you know what your rights are and what to expect, because no one wants things to go wrong, but sometimes they do go wrong.
Yeah, you can get a lot of information on this on the website with the book on it, www.thenakedtruthaboutbreastimplants. We have the foreword by Dr. Shankland, who was the premier silicone researcher in the 90s. He wrote a nice synopsis as a foreword, and then the table of contents. And then if you want the condensed version, I actually wrote something for an Australian book called The Naked Truth About Breast Implants Condensed Version, and we have that up on our website, www.plasticos.com. So if you want to take something to your doctor but don't think that they'll do anything with the book but throw it in the trash can, go ahead and download that paper or one of the other papers. Doctors, are you listening? There's a number of papers there, but especially that Naked Truth paper. You can take that to your doctor, and hopefully they'll be able to understand the concepts in that paper that we've been, Hildy and I have been covering the last several hours.
Excellent. And I appreciate you being on the show. And I know the music's in the background, so we've come to the end.
Sure.
I wish you the best of luck with your book and everything else. And I will be in touch with you, and we'll do some collaborative work to get some nice protocols for these ones that have gone to these injection parties so we can get that silicone out of them.
Well, thanks so much, and I look forward to that.
Okay, thank you. And God bless you, audience. I enjoy the show. Bye-bye.